This episode of A Glass for Every Palate is brought to you by the new season of Verticals. It is premiering next month. Oh my goodness, guys. So many amazing wineries. Maya Thomas, Martinelli, Paul Hobbs, Clos Duval. You do not want to miss this. If you aren't yet subscribed to Somm TV, head on over to SommTV.com right now. You can sign up. It's only $5.99 a month or $49.99 a year. All right. Wow. Happy 2021, everyone. And welcome to season two. I cannot believe this, to season two of A Glass for Every Palate. I am so thankful for each and every one of you that tune in and listen. Season one was a blast. Let's hope we can top it off with season two. So let's get started. My guest today is one of the most inspirationally fly women I have ever met. She is a wine and spirit educator. She is a wine media personality. She is a business mogul. My guest today is Regine Russo of Shall We Wine. Hi, Regine.
Hi. When you were introducing me, I was like, who is she talking about?
Who's that girl? I just want you to understand what is going on here. This is such an honor to have you. So thank you for coming to sit down and chat with us. So here for A Glass for Every Palate, we start with a couple things. Like, it's relatively early somewhere. Are you drinking now? Do you have something in your glass?
You know, I do, only because I didn't want to feel left out.
Okay.
Because I was hoping you were drinking. Okay, good. I wanted to open the Pierpont Suave, the 2019, but I had a little corner of a Moulin Vin.
And so I'm finishing Beauge. That.
Yes. You know, I had to open some Beauge because of our girl, Sukari.
For in her sure. Honor. In her honor, we will sip some Beauge because that is a Beauge queen. I am actually, I was tasting something for something, a dish that I think I want to cook this weekend. So I am having a glass of Marques de Murrieta Rioja. This is from their Finca Igai. This is a 2015 Reserva. It's so freaking delicious. It is early in the day to be drinking a Spanish red, but it's good.
I think you can handle it.
I mean, I'm up for the challenge. I'm up for the challenge. And we'll see how this goes. All right. So we're both sipping reds. We're sipping something nice. So this has been, 2020 was, I feel like everybody needs to do a personal time capsule of last year with all that we've been through.
Right.
But I want to start with like the perspective of being a business owner in the wine business during this time where everybody, no matter what your niche was, had to pivot their business. First, tell us a little bit about your business because, girl, you do everything. You do tastings. You do virtuals. So tell us, give the people a little snapshot of Shall We Wine.
Okay. Shall We Wine is a little difficult to pin down, but you'll get it in a few words. So I won't give you my elevator pitch, but we're an experiential marketing company. So what does that mean? We are the people that distributors and importers hire to do activations. So you see my team and I at your local wine shop. You see us at festivals, demoing wine, educating consumers on wine. So before COVID, that was, I would say, 80% of our business, and the other 20 was events. So corporate events, consumer events, but all of the events have a wine and spirit education component to them.
Uh-huh. And so once the world shut down and we couldn't do this anymore.
Yes.
And you had to, now for some things, I'm assuming it was easier to pivot to being virtual than others. What would you say was the most challenging part of your business to pivot to kind of work in this new digital space that we've all been forced into?
Well, honestly, for me, there wasn't a difficult part. I knew what to hold on to and I knew what to let go of. You know, I knew we were not going to be able to do anything client facing. So, you know, although, people ask, like, could you go to this one little store? They're independent. Can you do this event? The answer was no, because it just wasn't safe. It wasn't safe for me. It wasn't safe for my contractors, and I wasn't going to do it. So I was able to let go of that part of the business quickly because it was evident that it was not going to happen in a safe way. What I was able to focus on is, you know, when something like this happens, and this isn't the first time I've been faced with difficulties in a business, I always ask myself, what do you have? And I knew I had clients, right? I had Zoom, which I quickly learned about Zoom. And so when I sat down to figure out what I could do, it wasn't difficult for me to pivot and to start and try something new. I honestly had nothing to lose.
I mean, what a beauty it is, like, in business when you can, you know, a part of successful businesses is, I feel like all business owners have that kind of fearlessness, like, look, I'm going to do it and it's going to work. I mean, that's such an interesting perspective to be like, you know what, this part's got to go. Let's focus on the things that will still work. Well, we've got the successful, thriving business, but let's now, I on this journey, sometimes we narrate backwards. So that's where we are today. Let's go back to Regine falling in love with wine. I know I've done a little research, so I know that kind of your first foray into France, and you're originally from Haiti. Were you born in Haiti?
I was born in Chicago, but grew up in Haiti. So my parents are Haitian, and I moved back to Haiti when I was less than a year old. So that's where I grew up.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. And then during your college years, you did a study abroad trip to France. Was that where you had your kind of love of wine? Is that where you fell in love? Was that the trip?
Yes, that was. And I wrote about it some years ago, and I the line was something like, you know, I can't remember my first kiss, but I remember the first sip of wine that transformed me. So
Wow. It
was, you know, I always say that I fell in love, and still today I'm in love with the culture of wine. It's not simply the liquid, the taste, you know, the terroir. It's really about the culture. And what I experienced the first time when I was in Besançon was I was invited to a family's house, and the father owned a wine shop, and he had, I don't know, it seemed like 8 bottles of wine on the table. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm this little Haitian girl from Chicago. What is this man doing with all of these bottles? But every time he opened a bottle, he told me a story. You know, he said something about the wine, and I was just like, this is one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had. And that was it for me. It was that conversation describing wine in the same way that you talk about literature, about art. I was hooked. I was like, this is it.
I love it. I mean, I'm smiling from ear to ear because I think that that's the best part of wine is the stories. Like, it's almost like being in you can look at bottles like books. And if you were in a library, just each book, each bottle's got its own thing, its own place, its own, wow. Okay, so we went on a college study abroad trip. We finished college. Did you immediately go into doing something in wine?
I did not, because I really didn't know what to do, or I wasn't aware of what a wine job would look or feel like. So it was some years later, after having experience in management and sales, I was working as a waitress. Isn't that a song? I was working as a in a cocktail bar. Okay. Anyway.
I was so hoping we came to a moment where you would serenade us. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I don't know why I do that. I do break into song. So,
we are here for it. Here for it.
But I was working as a waitress, and Jill Davis, and we're still friends, came in to do a staff training. And I'm sitting there at this staff training, and I had this moment, you know, goosebumps, and like the lights are going off, and I'm like, I don't know what she does for a living, but I want to do that. And I thought about it from more of an entrepreneurial perspective, not really getting a job. And I approached her and said, I wanted to do what you're doing. I have an idea for a business. Could we do this kind of training in people's home? And that's where Shall We Wine was born, in that moment in Chicago at Bandera Restaurant.
Wow. And it's so beautiful when like passion and purpose collide, right? And I think that this is a great time to tell the people you are also a published author.
Yes.
And so you in the most unique way have truly like blended all your worlds of passion and purpose. So we talked a little bit about the stories and stuff. Is that how you segued into writing, or has writing always kind of been another one of your superpowers and an opportunity? But tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, I would never say writing is a superpower, because it is the thing that I am most afraid to do. It takes everything in me. I enjoy the results, but the process is still painful. So to answer your question, for so long, I divided all of my talents and interests. I thought that I could only be one thing at one time. So I could only be an entrepreneur, only be a writer, and never did I imagine a life where all of these things could blend together and give me satisfaction and give other people satisfaction. So what happened was I've been writing for a long time, and I met Jeff Jensen and Mike DeSimone on a press trip and loved them. They're the World Wine Guys, and told them about my ambitions in the wine industry. And they said, you know, you should. And I told them I have a book, and they said, well, you know, you need to write more and tell us about your book. And when I told them about my book of poetry, they said, have you ever thought about pairing wines and poems? And I looked at them like they were the craziest people I've ever met in my life. but, you know, through their encouragement and their vision, they really helped me give myself permission to merge two things. And again, to go back to what you were saying, I've always known that wine, every bottle of wine has a story, and every poem has a story. And so the work for me in my book was merging the two stories and finding a place where the story of the wine and the story of the poem came together.
And so we birthed Searching for Cloves and Lilies, the wine edition. That is Regine's book. It is available. You can go to her website and purchase it. It is, I mean, I literally, you are an inspiration. And I don't know, I mean, if you had to think back, that boxing ourselves in, I think that it happens in so many spaces in our life, and even into wine, right? Like where if you started drinking French wine, people are reluctant to leave the places that they drink and drink other things. And the parallel in life is like, I went to college, I studied this, this is my profession, this is what I need to do. And it's so freeing to go, well, I can do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, and feel totally fulfilled. Do you think that boxing in and that singularity that you experience and that we all do sometimes, do you think that that's just something that like society imparted on you? Do you think it was upbringing? Do you think it was gender, a combination of all, race? What do you think kind of puts us into those linear trajectories of what our life should be?
Great question. So one of my favorite things to do is to speak to everyone, but I like to talk, especially to young people. One of the things that I teach the younger generation is that sometimes the older generation gives advice out of fear. So we give each other advice that keeps us in this box because we think it's going to help us or help the other person stay secure, right? So, you know, when I graduated, I studied theater. And so many people said to me, well, you can't make any money in theater. I mean, there are many people, you know, right now our theaters are suffering, but there have been many writers and actors and directors who have made a decent living in theater, right?
And they're happy. Because I know a lot of people that make a lot of money that are not happy at all with what they're doing.
Yes. So, and I think that's where that box comes from. We're told that happiness looks this way. You have to make this kind of money. You have to have this kind of job. And so I heard that message throughout my life. And I'm not blaming anyone. You know, I accepted it. But now what I tell young people is when someone gives you an advice that is based in fear, look at them and say, thank you for your opinion, but your fear is not my reality.
Gems.
And I say, come on now. I say that to people. I say it to myself. Like my own fear, right? Because I have fears about so many things, is not the reality. The reality is I've been able to do something when I put myself into it.
Yeah. And even how we define failure, right? Like we define, like, what is failure? Like an idea that I had didn't pan out. Is that really failure? Or is that just, I tried something.
Yes.
It didn't work based on the way I did it. I'll try it again a different way. You know, so redefining these things. And I feel that that happens in wine a lot. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit. And also you can talk to us about it in spirits, where I think people are a little bit more adventurous than they are in wine. So many times in talking to people, you know, it's like, oh, well, I don't touch the French stuff because that's too much for me. And it's like, well, what's too much? Is it that there's a language barrier in the actual label that's a turnoff? Is it the way you hear the people you're around talk about wine that because the vocabulary being used is not familiar to you, it's just off-putting? I think that, you know, in dealing with the public, and you have a lot of this, what do you see as when you meet newer drinkers? What do you hear about? What's the fear that they have that's kept them from kind of diving in and exploring more?
Shakira, that is such a great question. And one of the things that I appreciate about you and listening to the podcast is how you're able to make these connections between like where fear shows up and what keeps us from exploring all things and even wine. So what I think is happening with consumers, because that's the majority of the work that I do, is exactly what you said. This fear of exploring because there's a lack of understanding. So I am not going to explore Suave, right? Because I don't even know what it means. Is it like, I don't know where it comes from, as opposed to just giving yourself permission to have fun, because that's what wine is about. It's about exploring, having fun, and learning. You know, our friend Larissa always says, you know, wine is my passport. And it is, because it allows you to travel if you just open up your mind. Here's the other thing. I've noticed that there is, we need a new language, right? We have the Somme language. And then the consumers don't quite understand what the heck we are talking about. And I think that we need to be able to take what we've learned and be able to make it relatable to the audience in front of us, right?
I am in the congregation right now just waving my hands, because it's one of the reasons, you know, when I talk about wine to people, I love to use non-wine descriptors, right? Like I've used situational things to describe, like I love describing Merlot as like a person that's like a friend of a friend. It's not that you don't like them. They're lovely. But if they're not with other friends, you're not really that into them that much, right? That's how I see Merlot the grape. Now, of course, that's not Somme speak, but to somebody that has no concept of how grapes work, of how, especially in something like a red blend, what grape brings what to the party, when you completely take wine out of it and make it something situational, like that spark of light of, oh, Well, shit, that makes sense. Okay, I understand that now. So maybe Merlot is not going to be the dominant guest at the party. Maybe they're not the guest of honor, but they're sitting at the head table. They've got a place here. There's a reason that they're on this guest list. That makes sense to people. So when they go to a wine shop and someone goes, well, this is a red blend and it's got 40% of this and 30% of this and 20% Merlot, that person in the back of their mind goes, oh, here we go again with like, you don't really need it, but there's a reason that that little 20% is in that. And that conversation, when you can bridge and make those connections, it makes so much sense. And you and I are both of Caribbean descent. I was in a tasting group recently and somebody was describing, it was a wine that was quite textured. It was lovely, really. And, you know, the descriptions were, oh, like Greek yogurt and goat cheese. And then there was an Afro-Latina woman in the group as well. She was like, it's like yuca. And I'm like, yes.
Yes.
Yes, it is. It's this starchy, sort of milky sort. And there were other, a lot of Latinx and Black people on the call. And the second she said that, like everybody got it. And then there were other people on the call that were completely lost because they have no concept of what yuca is, right? And I'm like, well, see, that's kind of how other people feel when the tasting notes are bramble and bergamot and all these other things. And I'm like, what? And then you have geographic things where if I said spicy, you and I are Caribbean, right? If someone says to you spicy like jalapeno, a jalapeno is not spicy to me. If you said a habanero, now we're talking spice, right? If we talked about sour to someone from Southeast Asia, it's not a sour apple. You would probably say something like tamarind. That would resonate more. So I think that it's our job as we deal with the public to expand the vocabulary and expand the vernacular of wine to be more relational to people.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I try to do because I see the looks on consumers' faces and they're like, what are you talking about? I don't understand these tasting notes. And, you know, we need consumers, right? Because they keep us employed. They have to buy wine, you know? And so we need to cultivate a language that teaches consumers the basics, the fundamentals, but does it in a way that is really that they can connect to. And that's why I love Wine Folly. I think it is such a great book and it really helps to break things down. So, yeah.
Yeah. And spirits is so different, right? Somebody that likes tequila isn't averse to drinking gin unless they've already had gin a few times and didn't like it, right? When people go, oh no, I stay away from tequila, it's normally not that they have a fear of trying the spirit.
No. They have a fear of reliving that day.
Reliving some night, some tequila fueled night that they don't want to relive again. So I always am fascinated by that juxtaposition where people are not hesitant about like diving into new spirits. Like if you read a cocktail menu and the other things in the drink sound good, like you can put some random spirit in there and people don't even care if they don't know what it is, right? Mm-hmm. It's like passion fruit, vodka, chartreuse, I don't know what that is, lemon, ginger, honey. Okay, cool. That works for me. But for some reason in wine, when it's a place or a producer or a grape that people don't know, they're like, eh, I don't know. So I wonder, like, is the culture of spirits just more about having a good time versus being so serious compared to wine? What do you think about that?
I think that it's spirits are easier to understand. And also, we haven't built this snobbery around spirits.
Yeah.
Right? I haven't seen it. You know, of course, you have your higher end, you know, your
Scotch drinkers.
Exactly. And your cognacs. And you see that. But something about spirits, the way it's marketed isn't as snobbery, is not as exclusive as wine. And so I think a lot of people feel more comfortable exploring spirits because it seems like it's for everyone. Wine is for everyone, but we haven't always marketed wine in that same way.
Yeah. And I mean, we're doing such a disservice by not. So it's so great to see, you know, people like you just engaging consumers in a way that's like you have so much knowledge, but you're always so much fun. Like you just spark joy, your smile, your energy. I'm like, oh, my day was shit. Remember, it's so much fun. Yay. So you are one of the few people that I can't pin down in wine your place. Is there a particular country of wine that, like, it's got a special place in your heart? Or are you just like, listen, good wine is good wine. I don't care.
Oh, that's a great... I don't think anyone has ever asked me that question. No. The my place in wine is a place I haven't been yet. So I just have a lot of... When I tell you fun, I really do. And fun for me is opening a bottle with my friends who are not in the business and seeing their face just light up. I think I told you I recently opened the Charles Heidsieck Blanc de Blanc with a couple of friends for a New Year's celebration. And their faces, they were like, what in the heck am I drinking? And that is so exciting to me. And when I have those discoveries, you know, like one of my friends in the business says, hey, try this, you know, Blancfranc-ish, which Derek sent me a bottle recently. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I'm talking about.
Bob. So there,
yeah, it's all good. It all makes me happy. And I'm just here to explore it and share the joy of it.
Yeah, for sure. God, the joy. It's so, you know, I think that we've gone through so much in the last year, particularly in wine, with so much of the things that are wrong as far as race and gender. But it's been so refreshing and so rewarding to see somebody like you, like, look, I do me. I have fun. I host events. I'm on TV. I got morning news people having a good old time drinking at 7 o'clock in the morning. But I'm sure that you have experienced your share of challenges, not only as a woman of color, but as a woman, right? And all of these things. What has been the biggest change, I'll say, good, bad, or both, over the last year that you've seen when comparing like barriers or obstacles or challenge you may have faced as either a woman or as a woman of color or both? And how have those either improved or shifted or anything like that?
Yeah. So for me, the changes that I have seen have not been personal. It's been watching my colleagues, watching the space open up for more Black voices, for more Brown voices. So that's what I'm seeing. And I am here for all of it. You know, I started in the wine business, let's see, back in, y'all are gonna know how old I am, 1997, 98. I did leave for a while. So for me, you know, I've been in so many spaces where I've been underestimated, you know, where I've been overlooked. So it's always been, I've always had to make people pay attention. So by the time I decided to come back and rebuild this business in 2013, I was already prepared to say, hey, look at me, right? And to invest the time and the money, because it's like, it's an investment.
This is one.
Come on now. Come on now.
You need some coins if you want to dive into this.
Come on now. And so I was willing to do that. So by the time, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, when people started to pay attention, I was already in a good position. I had allies, I had connections. And don't get me wrong, a lot of the impact that that had in our industry, I have benefited from. You know, people want to work with me, people see me. But I really, honestly, what I'm loving is how other people are being seen.
Yeah.
And how other people are being given a chance. And I think it's great.
It is. And I'm just so happy to see, like, we're a year into this now, and it doesn't seem like there's momentum being lost. I'm still seeing so many scholarship opportunities available, so many people, young, particularly young women, which makes me so happy to see so many more young women finding their place in the world in general, not just in wine, but just leaning into, you know what? This is my personality. It's big, it's bold, it's in your face, but I know what I'm talking about. And I'm going to find a way to comfortably blend those two things. And I'm just overjoyed to see it.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. I can talk to you all day.
I know. I do want to throw one thing in that I have not seen and I'd love to see. I have not seen the distributor response to what's going on, because this is where the jobs are. I think the scholarships are amazing because you need the education to get the job. But I want to see initiatives where we are working with distributors, with the large wine companies, and really creating opportunities for these young men and women who are getting those scholarships.
Yes, for sure. And even just into other parts of the business, right?
Like, yes.
If you wanted to go into distribution, which is such an important part of the three-tier system that we have here in the States, it's less about, you know, knowing your grapes and region, and more about you understanding the business and cost estimations and shipping and all that
stuff. Can you sell something?
Can you sell it? You know what I mean? Sell me this pen.
Yes.
So I do hope to, I mean, I'm so excited. I definitely want to talk to, you know, the young women that were awarded the Becky Wasserman Scholarship when they come back from Burgundy, because I think that that's an opportunity, not, I mean, what an opportunity to go to Burgundy, but also to understand like the business of this. Like, how are wines selected for importing? How do you gauge? Like, is it a sixth sense that's helping you understand what the market wants, what it needs? How do you find this producer and make them important to the rest of the world? So I'm looking forward to seeing that stuff too, but I am hopelessly optimistic about all the great things to come, and I think that the momentum is here to stay, and I'm very proud and elated to be a part of it.
Absolutely.
So let's have a little fun with you.
Ooh.
Before we wrap up. We'll have a little fun. We'll play this little speed round.
Okay.
No deep thought into this. First answer that comes to your head. Okay, you are super positive, but you are human. So you've got your good days and your bad days. When you have a bad day, what's the first thing that you want to drink?
Ooh, all of the above.
All the things. Light them up.
Oh, that's hard. You know what? I'm going to go with champagne. If I had a really bad day, I'm looking at my shelf right now, I would probably open one of my bottles of Laurent Perrier Grand Siècle. I would just be like, I need this right now.
That is my favorite cuvée. That is, if you've never had that wine, splurge on it. Like, that is worth every single penny that you will spend. That is so, I never thought about, you know, that sparks so much joy for me. I normally think about it in terms of celebration, but that would probably lift the hell out of my spirits on a bad day too. Look at you just influencing the things. Well, now opposite question. If it's been a great freaking day, the stars have aligned and everything has gone right with your day, and you are coming back from your power walk, you are feeling great, what are you drinking then?
I would definitely grab like an aromatic white wine. Like, I'm just trying to get everybody to drink more delicious aromatic white wine. So I'm a huge fan, you may not know this about me, of Viogniers, especially Eden Valley Viogniers. Like, they make me happy. I mentioned the Pierpont Suave. I'm looking at this bottle right now. It's going to get drunk, okay?
It's going to get drunk.
Right. But yeah, if I'm having a good day, like, just to me, the secret in a aromatic white wine, it's like you got to look for it, and the minerality, the floral, you're like, yes, I'm happy.
Girl, I tell you, you just sparked a whole lot of laughs when you said that, because Viognier is literally my least favorite grape on the planet.
No.
I have publicly said I wouldn't mind if it disappeared off the face of the earth.
Okay, you know what?
Well,
I'm so glad to hear you say that. No. I have changed people's minds. So you're going to email me your address. I'm going to send you a little gift. And I double dare you not to love the Viognier that I send your way.
I accept that challenge, because our friend Eric Siegelbaum actually put me onto an Israeli Viognier that I loved. It is delicious. So I am open to rescinding my campaign against that grape. All right. Well, let's talk about grapes that you don't like then. That's the next question. What's a grape or a wine or a place? Wait, you're just not into it. It doesn't do it for you. It doesn't spark joy.
So there was one, but I have definitely changed my mind. And I know I'm going to forget the name of the producers that changed my mind. So I was not a fan of Gewurztraminer, Gewurztraminer. I've heard both.
I've heard both.
Okay. So I always say both just in case someone comes for me.
But they can go.
Yeah. Let them come. It's okay. I just didn't get it. Like, it did not make me happy. I didn't like that rose petal thing that everyone gets so excited about. And then I started drinking them from Alsace,
man.
And I said, Regine, shut your mouth.
Gewurz till it hurts.
Yes. I went on camera and I said, I was wrong, people. I was wrong. So one of them is Domaine Hochbach, I think is a pronunciation. I will send you. I will send you a photo, but I was so wrong. So that was the grape that took me some time to fall in love with.
Okay, fine. Now you're down with Team Gewurz till it hurts. I love Gewurz. It's one of my favorite wines to pair with spicy food because I just think that the nose and the palate are just the perfect balance, especially for spicier dishes. And then our last question is, what's a grape or region that people are sleeping on? I think I know where you're going to go, but that they should explore and drink more of these wines from this grape or from this place because they're good, really good.
Oh my God. You're going to, I feel like so many jumped out at me. I'm going to go with, there's so many. So I was going to say the Languedoc for the diversity and the price point, but I'm going to go back to Alsace.
Yeah,
I am, because you can float from a Cremant to a beautiful Pinot Blanc to Gewurz. I'm just
great,
like,
Riesling.
Yes. So that is one that I've been really turning people onto. So I'm going to stick with that. But like, so many jumped out at me, like when you said that. What did you think I was going to say?
I thought you were going to say from Suave, because that's, they're in the Jura. I think that in France in particular, I think those are underrated regions and undervalued, where especially, I think that people are often introduced to like the most popular regions in France that can also have them spending the most money. And so the Languedoc, the Loire, all of those parts of France just produce, there's such diversity in the wines they produce and like, again, just explore. Let go of the fear that's keeping you to one bottle or one place and just explore and have fun. Oh my gosh. Thank you so, so much for chatting with us today. This has been amazing. Before we wrap up, will you tell people where they can follow you, how they can get in touch with you if they want to talk more or find out more about doing business with you?
Absolutely. So my website is shallwewine.com. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at shallwewine. Or if you want to get a hold of me personally, I am on all the channels as Regine T. Rousseau.
Get that middle initial in there. Oh my goodness. Well, girl, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. Guys, thank you so much for listening. I can't believe that it's season two. Like, I want to be like, you like me. You really, really like me.
They do. We love you.
I appreciate it. And guys, till next week, thank you so much for listening. Bye. This episode was sponsored by Ferticles. Clos de Vaux, Paul Hobbs, Martinelli, Maya Kamis, legendary names in wine, right? You do not want to miss this season of Verticals. If you aren't yet signed up for Somm TV, head on over right now. You can sign up for just $5.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Get signed up so that you don't miss a single episode of a new season of Verticals.